and identify with the strong will that's in me. I couldn't allow myself to accept being incarcerated, especially for something that I didn't do. So that moved me very strongly. It was my faith and my determination to prove my innocence. My innocence was the driving force along with my will.
We have to leave it there. I want to thank you so much both for being with us, and a very happy holidays to you, Clarence Moses L. We'll link to your Facebook page at facebook.com/Clarence Moses L. This is Democracy Now!, produced by Mike Burke, Carla Wills, Laura Gatto, Diener, Dina Guzder. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. Next up is the evening news.
Oh, my Christmas, please.
You're all I want for Christmas.
Longtime KBOO community member Deborah Lieber read The Night Before Christmas for you, and it is available at kboo.fm/nightbeforechristmas2015. Happy holidays.
I've heard so much talk about you, Santa, but are you for real?
Are you for real?
Tune in Thursdays from 6 to 7 p.m. to hear Rose City Native Radio with your host, Jackie Malmstrom. Rose City Native Radio is a new public affairs program bringing you local and national Native issues and Native contemporary music. You can find more information about the show online at kboo.fm or find us on Facebook at Rose City Native Radio.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Grendel's, a neighborhood coffee house offering organic coffee, sandwiches for breakfast and lunch, and Wi-Fi. Proud to support KBOO, Grendel's is open every day at East Burnside and 8th. Information at 503-595-9550 or facebook.com/Grendel's Coffee House.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a vigil will be held this Saturday at Shemansky Park in southwest Portland to remember Sandra Bland, a black woman whose death in custody in Texas was ruled a suicide.
Members of Congress are urging Securities and Exchange Commission to continue work on new rules to make campaign spending more transparent, despite a cease and desist mandate inserted into the omnibus spending bill by congressional Republicans.
And on KBOO Evening News In Depth, we'll speak with Jamie Calvin, a Chicago independent journalist, about the unfolding drama in the wake of damning revelations about the police shooting of Laquan McDonald.
Good evening and Merry Christmas. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, December 24th, 2015. I'm Jackie Malmstrom.
And I'm Doug McVeigh. Sandra Bland is an African-American woman who was found dead in a jail cell in Waller County, Texas. She'd been stopped by a police officer for supposedly failing to signal a lane change. When she dared to dispute the officer's claim, he threatened to taser her, dragged her out of her car, put her in cuffs, and took her to jail, where she was found dead 3 days later. A Texas grand jury recently declined to charge anyone in Bland's death. Portland area activists are planning a candlelight vigil for Saturday at 5 p.m. in southwest Portland's Shemansky Park to honor the memory of Sandra Bland and other victims of police violence. We spoke with Tom Hastings, an assistant professor in the Portland State University Conflict Resolution Program and co-founder of the Portland Peace Team, to learn more.
I'm Tom Hastings. I'm with the Portland Peace Team.
Tom, you have an event coming up on Saturday. Could you tell us about it?
Well, a couple of days ago, I was really struck sort of emotionally by the news that there were no indictments returned on the death of Sandra Bland while she was in custody. Sandra had broken no laws. She was an African-American woman with a very bright future, and she was driving near her where she was going to be relocating to in Texas, and a policeman was behind her and really tailgating her, so she pulled right over, and then he pulled over behind her and gave her a ticket for failing to signal when she had merely been trying to get out of his way. And she told him that, and she was ordered to get out of the car. She was essentially dragged out. This guy said he was going to, quote, light her up. And it was a very unjust arrest. She broke no law. She was stuck in jail, and very suspiciously, 3 days later, was found hanged in her cell, in a solitary confinement cell, in a, supposedly a plastic bag over her face, over her head. The whole thing reminded me of South Africa in the 1980s, when all of these mysterious deaths in custody occurred. Bland had been assertive about her civil rights, her human rights, when she was getting arrested. And had just been treated abominably. The family rejects this notion of suicide, and I think anybody with any common sense, including me, I hope, we reject it. And the family's been they've been traumatized, now they've been re-traumatized by this, and as a dad of two African-American boys, I just felt like we have to do something. So I called a little vigil at Shemansky Park for this Saturday, the 26th at 5 p.m., candlelight vigil, just something quiet and dignified. Joanne Hardesty, who is the president of the local Portland NAACP branch 1120, said that she was going to go. I asked her if she would make the opening remarks, which she is going to do. And when you find Joanne, you find a force of nature. So when Joanne began to publicize this, it appears to have gone viral. So we expect a lot of people to be there, which is wonderful, because we're going to be sending photos to the family. We really need to stand with the family right now, in my opinion. And I hope from this vigil come some ideas. After Joanne makes her opening remarks, then anybody can speak up. And I'm hoping that we have not just an expression of solidarity with the family, but perhaps some ideas about what we can do in solidarity with a family that will also do something for us locally, something in Portland that will make a difference here.
All right. I've been speaking with Tom Hastings. He is helping to organize a vigil, a candlelight vigil, on Saturday, December 26th at Shemansky Park in the South Park blocks, about Sandra Bland, but also the other honor and remember the other victims of police violence over the years. Tom, thank you so much.
Thank you, Doug.
This is Doug McVeigh with KBOO News.
Michael Hirsch was a senior programmer and systems analysis for Lane County. He's also a 60-year-old cancer patient, having been diagnosed with stage 3 prostate cancer back in 2011. Hirsch underwent aggressive chemo and radiation therapy, and his cancer seems to be under control. He's been managing using medical marijuana to deal with some of the debilitating side effects from his treatment and his condition. A co-worker claimed to smell marijuana on Hirsch's jacket, which was enough for the county to order a drug test. When he came up positive, which is unsurprising since the inert THC metabolite can be detected in the urine for about 30 days after use, Lane County has a zero tolerance policy regarding use of marijuana, even medical marijuana, so yesterday they fired him. Hirsch's union, AFSCMEL Local 2831 reportedly plans to file a grievance and will fight to get Hirsch reinstated in his job. Hirsch plans to file for Medicaid, unemployment, and food stamps, and union members are reportedly setting up an online fundraising account to help him get by. Meanwhile, his treatments have left Hirsch broke, and he fears that he could become homeless.
Regional and national conservation groups, along with the Diné, or Navajo Nation, are taking joint legal action to seek justice for impacts to communities, the climate, and endangered species resulting from operation of the Four Corners power plant and Navajo mine in New Mexico. The groups on Tuesday filed a 60-day notice of intent to sue the Office of Surface Mining, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and other federal agencies for approving the project back in July. The approval prolongs the 52-year-old power plant and coal mine, among the most notorious for coal contamination in the country, through 2041, despite impacts from coal toxins to communities, the San Juan River Basin, its ecosystems, and endangered species. Community and conservation groups have exposed gaping deficiencies in the U.S. government's impact study of Four Corners power plant and Navajo mine. These include analysis of clean energy alternatives to prolonged operation of the coal plant, insufficient consideration of carbon pollution impacts, public health problems, threats to endangered species, water contamination from coal waste, and impacts to Navajo culture. Tuesday's notice, which cites violations of the Endangered Species Act, will be followed by additional claims under the National Environmental Policy Act relating to pollution impacts on climate, people, and local communities.
Despite a provision in the recently passed Omnibus Bill, which forbids the Securities Exchange Commission from finalizing any rule that would require corporations to disclose their political spending to investors, the agency's been advised to undertake the process of developing those rules anyway. Later this week, signed by dozens of members of Congress, encouraged the SEC to prepare rules but not attempt to finalize them until the end of the fiscal year, when the mandate expires. The Corporate Reform Coalition is a group spearheaded by advocacy organization Public Citizen. Their president, Robert Weissman, spoke with KABU reporter Robin Ryan about what steps can be taken to increase the level of transparency for corporate spending on the electoral process.
Nearly 100 federally elected officials from both legislative chambers have signed a letter to the Securities and Exchange Commission, which advises the agency avoids in the policy rider limiting the ways in which they can act as it applies to corporations disclosing campaign contribution activity to their shareholders. Is this an amendment that was sponsored by a specific member of Congress, or is it language that was crafted by committee?
I don't think we know who drafted it. It represents a general position among a lot of Republicans, so it's not like it was just carrying water for one company by one member. And just to be clear, so what it did is this is a provision in the spending bill that Congress just passed, and it's unrelated to actual government spending, but it would block the Securities and Exchange Commission from finalizing a rule that would require companies to disclose their political spending. So it's aiming to stop this agency, the SEC, from dealing with the problem of secret spending by large corporations.
A professor at Harvard in law and economics was asked to review the language in that rider. Can you share with our listeners the key elements of his assessment and whether or not it was accompanied by any advice?
Yeah, well, the key thing is this provision in the spending bill is trying to stop the agency from issuing this rule to deal with corporate secret spending. But because of the way it's written, we think the agency can go ahead and work on a rule. It can do everything up to finalizing and implementing the rule. And that's what the professor said. Professor John Coates from Harvard sort of looked at the language and said, look, there's still a lot that the Securities and Exchange Commission, the SEC, can do to move the rule forward, and that this provision only lasts through September 2016. So they can keep doing the work that they ought to be doing to get the rule ready, to propose the rule. They can do everything up to finalizing the rule. And even if they decided today that they were going to move ahead on this rule, the way rulemaking works in Washington, there's no way they would get it done by September anyway. So the provision does not need to get in the way of the agency doing what it should do, which is respond to the request from more than a million Americans that it issue a rule to force companies to disclose their political spending.
I've seen some indications that shareholders began sounding an alarm over corporate campaign spending prior to the infamous Citizens United decision by the Supreme Court of the United States in 2010. What efforts have you seen being made by investors to facilitate a greater level of transparency on this issue?
Well, what investors are doing are raising questions and introducing resolutions at companies' annual meetings, asking that the companies disclose all their political spending. And a number of companies actually now are disclosing in whole or part their political spending. But almost by definition, this is the problem can't be solved through voluntary action. The companies that are most trying to hide what they're doing just will continue to hide that spending. Even if everyone else is disclosing, it won't make that much difference. So we really need an across-the-board rule that can only come from the federal government. Investors are also asking not just that the companies in which they hold shares disclose, they're asking the government to require all companies to disclose. And we've seen that in the now 1.2 million comments that have been submitted to the SEC. We've got comments from very large investment groups, from state investment funds and pension funds, from all kinds of social responsible investing funds, from large investment groups. So the investor community has been really clear with the SEC that it actually wants a rule, but the agency has so far declined to act.
Talk about the role the Corporate Reform Coalition has had in this process and how your organization is involved.
Since Citizens United, there's really emerged a vibrant movement across the country demanding far-reaching reform on money and politics. The sort of big grassroots push, I think, has been for a constitutional amendment to overturn Citizens United. We've seen 16 states, more than 650 cities and towns across the country, pass resolutions calling for an amendment. Hundreds of members of Congress sign on calling for an amendment. We've seen big pushes across the country for public financing. And we've also seen a really aggressive demand for the most minimal thing the government can do in response to Citizens United, which is to at least require full disclosure of all the secret spending that's been enabled by Citizens United. And one of the easiest ways we can get there is with a rule from the SEC requiring companies to disclose their political spending. As I mentioned, there's more than 1.2 million comments have now been submitted to the agency asking for such a rule, and that has been driven through the efforts of a really broad coalition called the Corporate Reform Coalition. We're involved in spearheading that here at Public Citizen, but it involves dozens of organizations from unions to environmental groups, from socially responsible investors to consumer organizations, from state pension funds to private investment groups. And we've really seen a big coming together around this extraordinarily modest, common sense proposal that companies at least disclose to their investors what they're spending on political activity. And people just get this and overwhelmingly support it. We have not yet been able to push the agency to move. We've had two of five commissioners on the SEC supporting it, have not been able to lock down Mary Jo White, who's the chair of the commission, to get the needed three-vote majority to get the rule pushed through.
That about does it for the list of questions that I had prepared. I am tempted to ask about what folks can look for from Public Citizen in 2016.
Well, as always, we're going to have a super full agenda. There's just tons of work to be done on money and politics as the presidential race and the congressional race heat up. We're going to see really billions of dollars, record sums, flooding through the political process. And I think it's really going to get people galvanized for action. We're going to have some exciting things going on to try to deal with that. We've got a big push going to prevent passage of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the horrible trade agreement that would include the United States and countries in Latin America and Asia to really expand the worst elements of NAFTA and prioritize corporate rights over the rights of regular people in international commercial trade. We're going to be continuing our push for all kinds of health and safety measures to keep dangerous drugs off the market and to try to deal with the worst threat facing humanity now, which is the prospect of catastrophic climate change.
I've been talking with Robert Weissman. He is the president at publiccitizen.org. For more information, you can visit their website at citizen.org. I'm Robin Ryan, and you're listening to KABU News.
You're listening to the KABU Evening News on Christmas Eve here in Portland, Oregon. Stay tuned after this newscast for an interview with independent journalist Jamie Calvin, a prominent voice calling for police reform in Chicago. Calvin obtained the autopsy report on Laquan McDonald, which dramatically contradicted the original police version of the events leading to McDonald's shooting death at the hands of Chicago cop Jason Van Dyke. This will be followed by Rose City Native Radio at 6. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather will be partly cloudy with a 15% chance of rain, a high of 41 and a low of 31. Today in history, in 1826, more than one-third of the cadets at the United States Military Academy in West Point, New York, became involved in a drunken spree known as the Eggnog Riot, following a wild Christmas Eve party. Among the rioters was future President of the Confederate States of America, Jefferson Davis. Today is also the birthday of pioneering investigative reporter Isidore Feinstein, better known as I.F. Stone, born in 1907. He gives us our quote of the day. Every idea subverts the old to make way for the new. To shut off subversion is to shut off peaceful progress and to invite revolution and war.
It's 5:20, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
In response to the Supreme Court's freakish decision in 2010 to bestow political personhood on corporations, I got an email from a guy named Larry screaming that big money has plucked our eagle. Yes, it has. And the powers that be tell us that we shouldn't even try to undo this theft of our people's democratic authority, but instead should just try regulating corporate money, like maybe requiring them to disclose how much they're spending on campaigns. Now there's a bold stand for democracy. Give us campaign finance reporting regulations or give us death. Come on, we're bigger than that. Here are just a few actions for real change that you can take, teaming up with others right where you live. Amend. Two major coalitions are organizing to overturn the court's corporate money edict by amending the Constitution. One is freespeechforpeople.org, and the other is movetoamend.org. And both have action kits for raising the issue locally, petitions to be circulated, video and other good graphics to educate people, and a wealth of other organizing ideas. Localize. Pass your own local and state laws to stop the wholesale corporate purchase of our government. These include outlawing any corporate claim of personhood in your area, providing the alternative of public financing for your local and state elections, and banning campaign donations by corporations that try to get government contracts and subsidies. For information and help, check out publiccampaign.org and reclaimdemocracy.org. Confront. Yes, get in the face of power. Ask all candidates where they stand on corporate personhood and demand that top executives of big corporations located in your area publicly agree not to spend corporate cash on your elections. This is Jim Hightower saying, remember, the Constitution plainly says we the people, not we the corporations.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out at HightowerLowdown.org.
And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at LaborRadio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. California's labor commissioner is ordering Pacific Nine Port Trucking Company to pay $6.9 million in stolen wages to 38 drivers. It's a landmark case ruling that these drivers were misclassified as independent contractors. Teamsters Port Trucker Campaign spokesperson Barb Maynard.
This is great news for port truck drivers who are misclassified, but it's more than that. It's a whole lot more than that. What we're starting to see here and what the Teamsters have really been taking on with this campaign is the beginning of the end of a scheme that is illegal, it is rife with tax fraud, and it's led to a degradation of work in America.
Maynard says these wage theft cases were heard back to back, and California's labor commissioner was able to see that wage theft and misclassification of drivers is a pervasive, widespread port trucking industry problem. And Maynard says it's a nationwide problem for workers not confined to just one industry.
For many workers in America, particularly those who used to be in the middle class, those who are professionals, these are professional port truck drivers, by being misclassified as independent contractors, they are not only robbed of pay, but they're robbed of benefits. They're having to pay the taxes for the boss. They are not paying into the Social Security system, which is very dangerous, because what happens if some large portion of our workforce doesn't have any retirement security at all, even if it's just Social Security?
The drivers who won the $6.9 million wage theft judgment are still on strike at PAC 9 Transportation, and their struggle doesn't end with this legal victory.
They are absolutely determined to not only improve their own lives and their own families' lives, but to make sure that every port truck driver, not only at the ports of LA and Long Beach, but at all the ports across America, have their rights restored and have justice.
After 4 months on the picket line in the ATI lockout, steelworkers are taking a holiday break in Albany, Oregon, but they vow they will be back. And when they do return January 4th, they will be welcomed with a solidarity rally. Healthcare for All Oregon's Union Caucus is calling on working people, all working people, union or not, to join the January 4th rally. Organizers say the steelworker solidarity rally on the picket line in Albany, Oregon, January 4th, will show widespread support for USW Local 7150. The NLRB is seeking a federal injunction against Cablevision for the firing of a union activist at one of the company's call centers. Dorothea Perry's performance had been consistently described as exceptional in her 11 years at the company, but when she became the point person for a CWA union organizing drive, Cablevision fired her. CWA says Cablevision has a long history of labor law violations. Workers Independent News is made possible in part by the United Steelworkers. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
American Household Christmas Lights, a favorite holiday tradition, use up more electricity than some poorer countries, such as El Salvador or Ethiopia, do in a year. The bright lights strung on the trees, rooftops, and lawns in the U.S. during the Christmas season account for more than 6.6 billion kilowatt hours of electricity consumption a year. According to researchers with the Center for Global Development, that's enough power to run 14 million refrigerators. It's also more than the annual national electricity consumption of many developing countries. El Salvador, for example, uses just over 5.3 billion kilowatt hours per year. Ethiopia consumes 5.3 billion, and Tanzania about 4.8 billion. Researchers Todd Moss and Priscilla Agyapon used data from 2008 U.S. Department of Energy report and the World Bank to carry out their research. They note that the 6.6 billion kilowatt hours used by U.S. Christmas lights represents only 0.2% of annual U.S. energy consumption.
Haiti's president, Michel Martelly, has postponed a final round of presidential and legislative elections that had been scheduled for this Sunday. Haiti, the poorest nation in the Western Hemisphere, is experiencing widespread domestic unrest in the wake of the first round of elections back in October. The president's hand-picked candidate, Jovenel Moïse, came in first out of 54 candidates, despite being a political newcomer who was unknown to most voters, prompting accusations of voter fraud. Lively and sometimes violent street demonstrations have become common in the intervening months, prompting President Martelly to postpone the runoff until January so a committee can review the electoral process. For more, we have this report from Al Jazeera America.
In the capital city of the Western Hemisphere's poorest country, this is just another day. Tear gas often mixes with protest in Port-au-Prince as security forces struggle to maintain order.
So in many ways, this is really emblematic of part of the problem here in Haiti. You've got security, police forces crouching behind this wall here. Rocks are coming in. You've got a tank with water cannon that's blowing back protesters. And all this comes on the heels of trying to develop some sort of semblance of civil government in this country.
These demonstrations first erupted back in October amid widespread allegations of corruption and voter fraud during the first round of presidential and legislative elections. Since then, demonstrations have become a weekly, sometimes daily occurrence. So, last month, our team headed to one such march in Port-au-Prince.
So today is all about street power. Eight presidential candidates here in Port-au-Prince have basically brought their groups into the street to say, express their dissatisfaction over the runoff results. You can see that these groups are basically coming to the street, holding signs, and saying, the president's hand-picked candidate, by the name of Boyce, is somebody that doesn't represent this country.
The elections were scheduled for December 27th, but were abruptly postponed this week amid mounting pressure from street protests. Last week, President Michel Martelly ordered the creation of a special commission to assess the country's electoral process, trying to allay concerns of corruption by involving assistance from outside experts. But the move has so far not proved enough to placate the Haitian street.
Well, I think there's a lot of pent-up anger and pent-up aggression with the political class and with the electoral system in Haiti. I mean, most clearly evidenced by the fact that over 70% of voters simply stayed home and didn't vote in the presidential elections, right? And so you have a lot of this anger and this perception that this process is not fair and that Haitian people are not able to choose their leader.
International observers, led by the Organization of American States, which monitors elections across Latin America, largely certified the first round results. But a growing chorus of voices, including former Secretary of State Patrick Ely, say the process is far from fair, adding that the international community is at least partly to blame.
The Haitian economic elite is not only subservient to foreign interests, it is also blind. They think that because they live in the penthouse, having neglected the foundation of the building, that it won't crumble.
Haiti's recent political unrest also coincides with the upcoming six-year anniversary of a massive earthquake that rocked the Haitian capital and left at least 200,000 people dead, 1.5 million displaced. And yet, despite more than $13 billion pledged in international aid, more than 60,000 people remain displaced and living in tents. That's something that has only added to growing frustrations and a sense of even more disenfranchisement among many residents here in the Western Hemisphere's poorest nation. David Ariosto, Al Jazeera, Port-au-Prince, Haiti.
The landlocked Himalayan nation of Nepal has been wracked by humanitarian crisis for months, beginning with devastating earthquake earlier this year, which left 10,000 dead and many more homeless. Now the nation is facing an unofficial blockade by its powerful southern neighbor, India. The blockade has been practically evident for 3 months, resulting in shortages of food, medicine, and fuel through the Indian government, though the Indian government denies any official embargo on Nepal. The blockade began after the adoption of the new Nepalese constitution that failed to rectify the second-class status of Mahisis, or ethnically Indian Nepalese, who make up at least 22% of the population. The Mahisi protesters have clashed with the police and blocked a number of key southern routes into Nepal. However, many, including Indian journalists and activists, believe the government of India, President Narendra Modi, is supporting the Mahisi blockade by shipping in goods using alternate routes. Reporter Bismala Jilandi filed this report from New Delhi for our friends at Free Speech Radio News.
45-year-old Lakshmi Thapa is a domestic worker in New Delhi. She came to India last month after her husband, a truck driver in Nepal, was no longer able to continue his job due to the unavailability of fuel in the country.
Nobody wants to leave their home, but the situation over there now is very critical. People have lost their livelihoods. There's no oil, no gas. Everything has just stopped. It seems as if Indians want to send us a message that Nepalese will starve without their support.
Nepal depends heavily on supplies imported from India. But for more than 2 months now, all trade routes connecting Nepal to India have been blocked, leaving the country in dire straits. Thapa joined hundreds of other Nepalese nationals who work and live in India in a protest against what they say is an economic blockade imposed by India on their country. Thakur Khanal is president of the Indian Association of People of Nepali Origin.
India has been interfering in Nepal's internal matters for a long time. They see themselves as superior and want smaller countries like Nepal to bow before them and follow their orders. But Nepal is a sovereign nation. It's also a landlocked country, and according to international law, you can't blockade a landlocked country, even during times of war. It also goes against the long tradition of friendly relations between India and Nepal.
The blockade began a few weeks after Nepal adopted its new constitution in late September. The constitution, the first since the overthrow of the monarchy in 2006, left some minorities feeling seriously shortchanged, especially the ethnic Madhesis, who have since been on the streets voicing their anger. Madhesis are an indigenous group of Indian origin, though large numbers migrated to the southern plains of Nepal starting in the 1950s. As a group, they retain strong ethnic and cultural ties with India. According to the 2011 census, Madhesis account for 22% of Nepal's population. But Madhesi groups say the real number is much higher. For decades, Madhesis have accused the Nepali highlanders, who dominate the country's politics, of mistreatment and discrimination. Madhesi activist Sanjeev Yadav says they were hopeful that the new constitution would alter the situation that keeps Madhesis out of government positions and public service.
If you look at the Nepali army, the representation of Madhesis is just 3%. The same is the case with the police and other services. Madhesis are qualified to meet requirements, but are turned away without any given reason. We have a 30% quota in government jobs, but even in areas where we are the majority, the jobs go to highlanders who live in the area. They eat up our share of jobs because those who do the hiring prefer them. The result is that if you go to any government office, you will find hardly 10% of the employees are Madhesis, and the rest are Highlanders.
Clashes between Madhesi protesters and Nepali police have left more than 50 people dead since protests over the new constitution began in September this year. Proportionate representation in parliament, the creation of a larger autonomous Madhesh province, and an easing of citizenship norms are some of their key demands. While India has expressed its disapproval of Nepal's constitution, citing neglect of Madhesi rights, it denies any involvement in the blockade. Vikas Swarup is a spokesperson for India's foreign ministry.
There's no official or unofficial blockade by India of Nepal. We also want a resolution for Nepal's current problems, but the solution has to come from within Nepal after consultation with their own people.
But Prashant Jha, associate editor of the Daily Hindustan Times, is not convinced. Jha recently visited the border area and says Indian authorities are facilitating the blockade, if not imposing it.
While it's true that Madhesi protesters have blocked some routes and are not allowing vehicular movement into Nepal, the Indian security and customs officials have also tightened the border and are not allowing anything. There are many other routes through which we could have sent things, as we have been doing in the past. So at least an unwillingness and non-cooperation on our part is also clearly evident.
The blockade is now in its third month, and concerns are growing about its long-term impact in a country still battling the devastation of a massive earthquake that left nearly 10,000 dead and many more homeless earlier this year. According to the United Nations Children's Fund, or UNICEF, nearly 3 million Nepali children under the age of 5 are at a risk of disease or even death this winter if the blockade continues. The UNICEF statement sparked a heated debate in the Indian Parliament, with the opposition holding the Narendra Modi-led BJP government responsible for the situation. Manishankar Iyer is a senior leader with the opposition Congress Party.
Now, this is a human tragedy of such proportions that the least humanity should have led to our rushing teams to Nepal to work with the Nepali authorities on finding alternative routes or on pacifying the agitators. The children of Nepal are being told that they can't go to school because India is stopping them. The women of Nepal are being told that they cannot have food, fuel, medicines, vaccines for their children because India is stopping them. We have to make it clear to the Nepalese that India is not harming them. It is the Modi government that is harming them.
The Indian government has agreed to send an all-party delegation to Nepal to help the Nepali authorities and Madheshi protesters reach an agreement, but has not yet set a date. On Monday, India's Ministry of External Affairs welcomed as a positive development a move by Nepal's cabinet to send a bill to Parliament to amend the constitution, accommodating some of the demands of the Madheshi protesters. But for now, the blockade remains in place. Bismillah Gilani, Free Speech Radio News, New Delhi.
And now, the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center at www.imemc.org for Thursday, December 24th, 2015. As Palestinians mark Christmas in Bethlehem, Israeli troops shoot and kill three Palestinians in separate attacks across the West Bank. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. Wissam Abu Ghawali from the Kalanda refugee camp north of occupied Jerusalem was shot and killed on Thursday morning by Israeli troops manning Jabaa military roadblock. According to Israeli sources, Abu Ghawali drove his car too close to the roadblock. They claimed that he hit a soldier with his car and that one soldier reportedly being mildly injured. Eyewitnesses said that soldiers fired more than 30 live rounds at the Palestinian car, which was driven by a young Palestinian man after he was involved in a traffic accident. Meanwhile, a Palestinian man was shot and killed on Thursday morning in Hebron Old City in the southern West Bank. The man who was killed was identified as Iyad Jamal Idris, 26, from the Yatta town south of Hebron. After the shooting, the Israeli military claimed that Idris had attempted to stab Israeli soldiers with a screwdriver, but there was no evidence of that at the scene. Earlier on Thursday, Israeli soldiers invaded various towns and refugee camps in Hebron district and kidnapped 8 Palestinians after breaking into their homes and violently searching them. A third Palestinian man was shot and killed by Israeli forces on Thursday morning after allegedly stabbing and wounding 2 Israeli guards at the industrial park outside Ariel settlement, the largest Israeli settlement in the West Bank. The guards, one male and one female, both 24 years old, were allegedly lightly wounded. The Palestinian who was killed has been identified as Muhammad Abdul Halim Zahran, 22, from the Kafr Ad-Dik town west of Salfit. On Thursday at dawn, Israeli soldiers invaded several Palestinian communities in different parts of the occupied West Bank district of Nablus, Tubas, and Hebron, searched dozens of homes, and kidnapped 13 Palestinians. In other news, thousands of Palestinians marked the Christmas festival in Bethlehem City on Thursday, the birthplace of Jesus Christ. The festival started with bands performing at the major square, where locals and international visitors gathered outside the Church of Nativity. According to Palestinian sources, few visitors showed up this year as Israel continued its daily attacks on the city and other cities in the West Bank.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Ryan Fritcher, Doug McVeigh, and Robin Ryan. The producer is Sam Bowman. Special thanks to Free Speech Radio News. Our engineer is Matthew Olson. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews, or look for us on Twitter at KBOO News. You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River 91.9 FM. I'm Jackie Malmstrom.
And I'm Doug McVeigh. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO, at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, Ani and Lynn host Positively Revolting Talk Radio with a seasonal theme. At 9, One Land, Many Voices features an encore broadcast of The Plight of Christians in Bethlehem, a program which originally aired in 2009. And at 10, we hear a two-hour special from Global Voices for Justice featuring progressive journalist David Talbot talking about his book, The Devil's Chessboard, Alan Dulles, the CIA, and the Rise of America's Secret Government. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support this year. Have a great holiday season.
Now for KBOO News in Depth, featuring an interview with independent Chicago journalist Jamie Calvin about the police shooting of Laquan McDonald and its recent political fallout. Good night, Doug.
Good night, Jackie. Good night, Matt.
Good night, Matt.
Good night.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Thank you for listening to the KBOO Evening News. I'm Sam Bowman. On October 20th, 2014, Laquan McDonald, a 17-year-old black man armed with a knife, was shot 16 times by Chicago police officer Jason Van Dyke in an industrial neighborhood on the Southwest Side. Over a year later, Van Dyke was charged with murder, the first Chicago police officer to be so charged for an incident that took place while on duty. The delayed indictment was due mostly to the evasive and opaque response of the city government and police department, which is an attitude as synonymous with Chicago as icy roads and deep dish pizza. The mainstream local media largely followed the city's line on the shooting, which was that Van Dyke fired only a few shots as McDonald approached him aggressively, and that McDonald died after being transported from the scene. However, pressure was kept on the city for over a year to release McDonald's autopsy report and dashcam video of the incident. The video was eventually released on November 25th of this year, hours after Officer Van Dyke was charged with murder, and the autopsy report was obtained as the result of a lawsuit brought by independent journalist Jamie Calvin, and it showed that McDonald was shot 16 times and died at the scene. Both pieces of evidence show a far different story than what had so far been made public, one that paints the city's version as an obvious cover-up and has inspired outraged protest in the city and across the nation. Many have called for Mayor Rahm Emanuel's